This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This is how it's always been. I'm on the outside looking in.
Welcome to Double Love, the podcast in which we explore the strange and terrifying world of Sweet Valley High, book by book. I'm Anna Carey.
I'm Karen Moynihan.
And we are back with a death threat.
I guess. I mean, we're still not convinced it's an actual death threat, but all right, whatever.
Oh, I mean, everything about this shoddy operation is inaccurate. Like
the most ramshackle fucking thing I've ever come across. This whole thing from start to finish.
Everything about this crime makes no sense.
No. Oh God,
on many levels.
Oh, like, look at it. If you've come here for sense, you are going to be disappointed.
Oh, that should be the motto of this podcast and this book series as a whole.
Accurate.
Well, we cannot start with taglines and blurbs because we did all that last time, but we can start with the cover. Now, first of all, we'll have the boring old British cover. Can you describe it, please?
Yes. Well, we have our standard silky background. That's fine.
Of course.
And then it's just like a bunch of dollars. It's a bunch of 20s, like kind of all stacked up, scattered around. There's a big old like mobile phone. It's like an old Motorola or something. You know, the big proper brick type ones.
The cellular phone.
That's the one. So that's sitting on top of all the pile of money. And then there's like the chain of a necklace is kind of strewn across, but there's no like pendant or locket, which I guess this is what it's meant to be. Echoing from early on in the book when Jeremy rips the fucking locket off of Sue. And then there's like these little very fake petals from like clearly a fake flower just kind of scattered across for reasons. Ooh. Who knows?
They are, because I could just see a very low res version of this cover from like that's on eBay. And I thought that might be the necklace, but no, just random petals.
Yeah, it's
no
random
sense.
Petals. I feel like we've had random petals on some of the other covers as well in this series. And they didn't make sense then and they don't make sense now.
Just something in the photographer's bag of props.
They just had them there. They were like, this needs something else. Throw in some shitty looking petals. Ooh.
Well, this cover may be boring, but you know what isn't boring? Oh, and that is Cressida Burton's magnificent tableau.
I mean, I don't know how you do it, Cressida. It's so good. It's just consistently so fucking good. Like, where do I even begin? Where to start? Like,
it's absolutely incredible. Like, there's even two backdrops to create the split screen sort of montage effect.
It's amazing. I've actually only just noticed the picture frame that's been drawn in the background to mirror the one in the Wakefield house. Like, this is stunning attention to detail. I'm in awe, honestly.
Oh, same. And like, can you try and describe it?
Oh, God. Well, we have our the Cindy doll who has been established as Sue quite well by now.
Oh, yeah.
Tied to a chair. She's wearing her little black witch's outfit. She is tied to the chair with like a teeny little piece of twine that looks like rope. It's so good.
Black chair, like on the cover.
Incredible. So yeah, black chair. She is all draped in black, tied to the chair. And like, it's really, it's things like the menacing hands in the foreground with an old phone looming towards her. And hats off to both Cressida and her hand model hunk, Mr. B, who unfortunately now thinks she's unhinged. But like, oh my God, it's so good. It's incredible. Like, it's a Motorola Razr actually is what's doing the job of the cellular phone. And like, what a blast from the past that is. Like,
oh my God. It's and what can you describe the other side?
Yes, because of course this is just one half of the picture. Because on the other side, we do in fact have a much better looking Jeremy, I will say.
Better hair.
And he's accompanied by Jess and Liz. And we do have like a proper Jessica doll in the background watching this all unfold. And I think we possibly have Barbie standing in for Liz, like in her little SVH jacket. And
oh
actually,
my God.
The alt text for this on Twitter is also worth reading. So actually, Cressida's own description is: a copy of Sweet Valley High book 110, Death Threat, is seen alongside a recreation of its front cover made with dolls. The scene depicted shows a dark-haired Cindy dressed in a witch costume and lashed to a chair in a forest cabin. Her ex-fiancé, modelled by a Troy from High School Musical Ken doll, is now chatting on the phone to the kidnapper with his new fiancé, a far too cheerful Jessica Wakefield doll, and her twin sister Elizabeth, a Barbie. A vintage 1990s phone held by a manly hand looms large in the foreground. It's all a bit bonkers, to be honest.
I mean, bonkers or magnificent.
It's not, like, I swear to God, that alt text description is better written than like this entire series.
Genuinely, yes. So Cressida does say she doesn't feel it's her best work. Oh, you're too harsh on yourself. She says, I only have one blonde doll. So Mrs. Hare is actually Barbie's... Barbie's horse's tail.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That is amazing. But that just shows the levels of fucking ingenuity at play here, because, like, who would have ever thought? That's amazing. I applaud you, Cressida. You are just knocking it out of the park consistently. And oh my God, I love this so much.
She also says, all the dolls look far too happy as usual. Typical. And that she gave Jess a cup of coffee just to show how little she cares about Sue. It says that the new Randy Randall is a Troy High School Musical Ken doll. So especially a Ken. I picked up for a quid in a charity shop. Oh yes, I've started investing in these horrors now.
Oh my God, I need to see like the prop cabinet or the prop drawer, because I just feel like it's a treasure trove of good shit.
I both want to see it and don't want to be surprised. I don't want to be spoiled for future episodes.
But, oh God, just
it's seriously
it's so good. It's
we'll
so
put
good.
It back on Twitter and on Instagram, but. This is, I cannot overestimate or overstate.
Yes.
I'm speechless with wonderrest.
You need to go and see it, is basically the bottom line here. You need to go on Twitter or go on Instagram. If you don't have either of them, just go there anyway. You can probably have a look without logging in, because my God, it just, you have to see it, and that's all there is to it.
Thank you so much, Cressida. We appreciate these unhinged tableau so much, and this, I know you said it wasn't your best work, but I think you're just getting better and better with every book.
100%, yeah.
And obviously so much better than both the inspiration and the crappy UK covers that we got here.
Oh boy. Yeah, agreed.
Well, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Let us begin. I was going to say the last half, but it's actually more like the last third of Death Threat. And we begin with Todd. He's all worried about Liz, and he's like, maybe she was grounded. And then goes, grounded from school? What was he thinking? Like, what indeed, Todd? But then he gets a call from Lila.
He does, and he has to try to stop himself from sounding so incredibly disappointed that it is in fact Lila and not Liz ringing him, because at the end of our last episode, Lila has jumped to the conclusion that the Wakefields are all being held hostage, because she couldn't figure out what Jessica was saying down the phone to her when she was trying to explain the situation, while like everybody else was in the room. It was ridiculous.
So
Lila starts the conversation and she's like, the Wakefields are being held hostage. And Todd at first is like, what are you talking about? You're being ridiculous. But it's such a silly conversation, because that's how she starts. She's like, the Wakefields are being held hostage. He's like, what are you talking about? The Wakefields are being held hostage, Lila repeated. The Wakefields are being held hostage, Todd Scott. I was like, oh my God, are we just looking for a word count hit here? Like, what is going on?
This ghostwriter was 100% trying to hit a word count, because there is so much filler and padding, like entire descriptions about Alice's cake, like serving. It's just, preposterous.
So true. But yeah, so this conversation goes on for a bit, but basically Lila convinces Todd that this is in fact what's happening, because she explains indeed about how Alice was being all weird and squirrely earlier that day. Ned was all gruff on the phone. No one's seen the twins all day, or like, well, she saw Jess briefly through a window or whatever. But anyway, she convinces Todd that something weird is going on. So he wants to call Liz, and she insists that he can't because they might provoke the kidnapper. And she says, maybe we should call the police. And Todd is like, oh, I don't think the police would come without any evidence. And we also know by now the police are absolutely fucking useless in this town anyway. So have to give them that, I suppose. So they decide they're going to go check it out for themselves. So Lila says that her and Robbie are going to pick him up in 15 minutes.
So Lila turns up at Robbie's house. We get a reminder of how fucking stupid their fights are, because it's not until she gets to his house she remembers that they're actually not speaking, but she needs his help because they need somebody to sort of be a lookout, come getaway driver while they're checking out the house, and she knows she can trust him. So he's surprised to see her, but he does follow her straight away to the car. And then when they're in the car, they both do the whole, I'm sorry, no, I'm sorry. And I have to say, I was relieved to see that Robbie apologizes for actually trying to, you know, tell her she couldn't pose naked. For like, nobody mentions the fact that if her whole story was true about her dad's friend, it would be incredibly creepy.
Oh, that's so great. Like, those two situations were absolutely not comparable in any way, shape or form. But look, they forgive each other, it's all fine, they figure it out, and it's grand.
she does admit that it was a stunt, and she says, I can't believe it. Robbie exclaimed, foiled again. Lila Fowler, you are certainly a handful. Lila smiled to herself, she was a handful, and Robbie was just gonna have to get used to it.
Oh God, well I hope not, because their relationship has gotten really fucking annoying, so I could do with less of it.
Oh my God, I can't, just cannot take much more of Lila, you know, and Robbie having completely contrived staged fights and then making up in 2 seconds. One was more than enough.
Definitely, because this is just like, it's getting repetitive. But anyway, they pull up outside Todd's house, and Robbie's like, wait, what are we actually doing here? Lila, and it's so funny how like throw away this line feels, because she's like, oh, I almost forgot, the Wakefields have been kidnapped.
Robbie does not, as I think most people would, go, hang on, what the fuck?
He takes it all in his stride.
Well, he certainly, I was going to say he sort of absorbs Sweet Valley in ways, but I guess he lives in Sweet Valley the whole time. I mean, who knows? They all head to Calico Drive anyway, and for some reason the house is completely dark and looks as if it's been abandoned. And Robbie says the shades are probably just drawn. There's so much contrived spookiness in this book. They decide Lila and Todd will investigate. Robbie will stay with the car. And as they leave the car, we're told the Wakefield home is still shrouded in darkness, giving off the impression of a haunted house. Except we're told the light's on upstairs in Liz's room. There's a crack in the curtains.
It's absolutely fine. Like, it's just that it's nighttime on Calico Drive, that's all. But also, it is quite funny, because I didn't realize this until kind of rereading it earlier today, that like, Lila's car is a two-seater, and like, her and Todd and Robbie are in it. Lila's driving, so is Todd sitting on Robbie's lap? Is that what's happening here?
I mean, I guess. Like, they don't care about road safety in Sweet Valley. Well, we do know that.
Yeah, because it does say like that Todd and Robbie were crammed together in the front seat of Lila's two-seater car. So who's on whose lap? I need to know.
Well, they've got no time for snuggling up, because Todd remembers that we learn a lot about the architecture of the casa. He remembers there's a small decorative window in the kitchen that doesn't have a curtain. So they have to, we're told, shimmy across the lawn on their bellies, basically commando style.
Essentially, yes. Lila is extremely unimpressed that that this is how she has to maneuver her way around the corner of the house, because Todd is insistent that they can't be seen, so they have to, as you say, shimmy across and kind of make their way across the lawn. Lila's disgusted. She's like, "Ugh, I'm ruining my jacket. This is the worst." But they make their way across.
Yeah, we are told that her jacket is made out of black leather, which is literally the ones, you know, sort of garment that would not get ruined.
It's, if anything, it's ideal shimmying across the grass kind of wear. So really, I don't know what she's complaining about.
Well, they get around the house and we learn that somehow, I mean, which way is the split level working? I just thought that that was like some of the house is one story and some of it's two story. But apparently the windows of like the kitchen are so high off the ground that Todd has to like pull himself up. I mean, I am 5'2" and I can just stand there and see right into my kitchen.
Yeah, it's very strange because they do say he has to pull himself up, and I was like, do they just mean like he was crouching and now he's just kind of like popping his head up? But then it just, the way it's worded is literally like he's having to do a pull up to see in this fucking window. Like, it's very strange.
And we're told again they are like babies in so many ways, the Sweet Valiants, because we know they don't do object permanence, and now we know that they, I guess, think that somewhere in the dark is like a totally different place, because we're told the usually bright and gay Wakefield kitchen was grey and foreboding, covered in shadows. Todd shivered and dropped down. I mean, the light's just off.
Like, oh my God, it's just a dark room. Everybody relax. But yes, they're basically like, yeah, they've got themselves all het up with this whole kidnapper idea in their head. So everything seems really spooky, and they're like picturing like men standing over Liz with a knife and all this kind of thing. Like, it's all very dramatic for absolutely no reason. Because yeah, apparently there's a side window of the family room that Todd has to like jump. Todd is 6 foot tall. He's jumping and he can't see in this window. Apparently he's a full foot short of it.
What?
And it's like, what is this weird fucking window in the sitting room that's like way up high? That just, it sounds so odd.
Stairs, like, I mean, my husband's 6 foot, around 6 foot, 6 foot one, and I'm trying to visualize how high he would have to jump, and he's not a basketball player, to not be able to reach, to be a foot away from a window.
Bizarre. But like, yeah, so basically Lila has to get up on Todd's shoulders to peer in the window. Like, I don't know what's going on with these windows. It's ridiculous. But she does eventually get a look in and can see the twins and Mr. and Mrs. Wakefield, and they all look really miserable where they're all sitting. But then she notices that there's somebody else in the room. So there's some like guy who's about 6 feet tall and wearing a baseball cap. So Lila's like, oh my God, the kidnapper is here. So he's kind of moving around the room towards the window. So she kind of panics, and they jump back down and sort of basically run away, I think.
Yeah. So they're just like, so much for commando style.
Basically, yeah, that's all over with now. So they tell Robbie that the kidnapper is there with the Wakefields. But she reassures Todd that everyone's fine. Like, nobody looks injured or anything, but everyone looks miserable. And the kidnapper was stalking around the room. But of course, she couldn't make out any of his features or what he looks like at all, because with the baseball cap, she just couldn't see his face.
I mean, how was this baseball cap positioned that when he was walking around the room, you couldn't see anything and, you know, possibly, I don't know, recognize him from somebody who you see all the time. But
They're also looking from like a 7-8 foot vantage point.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot about the insane architecture of this house.
They're looking at him from quite a height.
So Todd wants to go back to the house and like take on this one kidnapper, because they're likely to be two against one. But yeah. Lila says courage is worthless in the face of a gun, because she's sure that this kidnapper is armed. Mm-hmm. So Robbie agrees, and they decide they can't call the police either, because Todd has a fantasy of the police surrounding the house and shouting through megaphones.
Yeah, like, well, again, would you trust the Sweet Valley Police to handle anything at all properly? So
true.
You know, I can't really drag them too much for that, I feel like.
Fair. Well, they decide the best place to come up with a secret plan, because they obviously need to, you know, take this into their own hands, is, of course, the Dairy Burger.
Of course, yes. Where everyone else is.
I seem to recall that other people were like making secret plans of the Dairy Burger in recent books. I don't know whether it was Liz and Bruce, but this is not the first time in relatively recent history that people have decided the best place to like talk in private is the place that all their friends are in.
Nobody will notice. It's fine.
So yeah, Todd can't believe all their pals are just, you know, going about their business as normal while Liz is held hostage. And Lila decides that the best approach is to do things out in the open.
Yeah, so Robbie jumps on the idea and he's like, yes, she's right. We've got to walk right up to the front door to like make the kidnapper let us in. So Todd is like, oh, so like go dressed as cops or something. But Lila's like, no, not that. But she's like, but some kind of disguise that the kidnapper will have to let us in. So Todd again is like, so like plumbers. But anyway, they eventually kind of run through different kinds of like occupations where like if someone turns up at the door, you'd want to let them in. So it's like firemen, and they think about how that would work and where the fuck they would even get a fire truck. But they're kind of listing out things, and they're like plumbers, sanitation workers, the telephone company, electrical workers, and then Robbie's like, electrical workers, that's it, because his cousin Sydney quite handily works at Sweet Valley Power.
In fact, not only does he work there, despite the fact that he seems to be about the same age as Robbie, he is a vice president in the corporate office of Sweet Valley Power, and thus could get them SVP worker uniforms and maybe a truck. I don't know. There's many questions to be asked about Sweet Valley Power. If this is a publicly owned company, like, their tax dollars are not being put to good use.
When are they ever in that town, in fairness? But yeah, so they hatch a plan that they can turn up as like electrical workers and say that they need to check the basement to where the breaker box is. And they come up with some story anyway that they're going to have to like make sure everything's fine with the power, basically.
Yeah.
Because apparently it's a town ordinance that all residents have to give electrical workers access to the breaker boxes in an emergency. Like, why would you know this, Robbie? Like, what is this fucking extraneous detail all about? But yeah. But yeah, they decide this is the plan to go with, because the kidnapper will have to like hide the gun and act normal while they're there. So it'll be the perfect time to ambush him.
And they're going to ambush him with a fire extinguisher, essentially flame retardant spray. Mm-hmm. And Todd, who's been fucking useless so far, decides to, we're told, take charge, and that he's going to go down to the basement to check the fuse box and turn off the breaker box. I guess that's like the fuse thing. Mm. And they cut off the lights, and in the ensuing confusion, Lila will spray the kidnapper. What could possibly go wrong with any of this?
Oh, it's watertight. This plan is foolproof. Nothing could possibly go wrong.
So they realise they have to wait till tomorrow, even though Todd wants to do it right now, because they have to wait till office hours to get a fire truck.
Yes.
And Todd wonders how he'll make it through the night. So the next morning, everyone is anxious at the Casa del Wakefield because it's D-Day, as Elizabeth thinks, drop-off day. Mm-hmm. And she and Jessica were the decoys. They're de-lovely and delicious.
Yeah, so she's been going over her notes because, of course, she's been playing girl detective and like scribbling down everything she overhears, basically. But she still can't really puzzle it out. She's kind of just like rereading what she's written, and it's like, ransom amount equals inheritance. Kidnapping occurs on day Sue to receive inheritance. And it's like, who would want to harm Sue? And she just can't crack this fucking case. But she can hear Ned and Alice chatting with Sam Diamond, of course, Ned's old buddy, private detective that he's been keeping secret this whole time. They're chatting in the study privately. So she creeps down the hallway because she wants to hear what's going on, because she's not getting anywhere with her own little notes.
And she justifies this eavesdropping to herself, as she did when she justified eavesdropping on Sue and Alice talking about her like will, because she says she has to know what's going on in there if she's going to help Sue, and a good reporter has to have all the facts, right? So she basically sticks her ear up against the door and hears Sam say, you know, there's no cases of kidnappings that match this one. And there's a reference to something in Santa Monica, like that wasn't one of the mystery, like the Sweet Valley summer spectaculars, was it? It just seems very specific.
It is specific, isn't it? Because they even say like the little Collins girl, and it's like, oh, that was orchestrated by a drug ring, and it's like, what are you talking about? What is this like? And we haven't done all the like super thrillers, so it could be something related to that, or it could just be more random unnecessary detail, you know. Either thing is very possible.
Well, Sam has ruled out sort of professional, you know, drug cartels, and does say that it doesn't look like it's Phil Schmidt, because he's, God, Phil Schmidt, 45 years old, he's younger than me.
Oh God.
So apparently he comes from old money. He's from Greenwich, Connecticut, and he's like, he runs an ad agency, and he, you know, Alice is like, well, wasn't he given the trust of Sue's millions? Sorry, what am I saying? Sue's 500 grand.
Half a million, her paltry half a million.
Like, why wasn't he the recipient? And Sam points out, look, Phil Schmidt's independently wealthy, so he doesn't need it. And also he'd be in a really awkward situation if he was given this money and had to sort of, you know, take it from his stepdaughter.
Yeah.
So I guess we've ruled out Phil Schmidt, unless he pops up in the next book. That's it. Yeah. So Alice, what, you know, is sorry, and Ned is like, well, what do you suggest? And Sam says she thinks they have to go through with the drop. And Liz is appalled at the thought of giving the kidnapper what he wants. And so Alice is worried about giving the kidnapper access to her beloved twins.
Oh, suddenly she's parent of the year. But yeah, so Sam reassures her that the girls won't be in any danger. They'll be fully protected at all times because they're going to be equipped with bug devices, and Sam is going to be right on their tail the whole time. So she does this thing where it's like, now this is the plan, and then starts whispering. So like, Liz can't really overhear everything. It's that classic cutaway thing. Yeah. But she does hear that, yeah, apparently Ned is going to go out to the bank today to pick up the ransom. And Liz just can't hear the rest of this sentence or what else they're talking about afterwards. But then when she hears them all moving around, it's like they're clearly about to come out. So she's like, oh shit. So she like legs it into the kitchen to try and be all nonchalant while she's like stuck to the wall. It's very strange because Ned walks in and she like hops on a stool and tries to look normal. And it's like, you were clearly just like plastering yourself against the wall trying to hide. And now you're just like, oh, I'm just sitting here not doing anything, don't worry about it.
We do learn that like this is the first Liz hears of the fact that they're going to be, you know, wired for sound and that Sam will be with them, which, you know, I think it would have been reassuring to the girls to tell them this before now. In fact, sorry, what am I saying before now? They still haven't been told. She just overheard it.
Exactly.
So, Liz is, you know, now I guess she's somewhat reassured that at least they're going to have a bodyguard. Mm-hmm. We cut to the cabin. Sue's still tied to a bloody chair. She's basically, we get like, I'm not joking, about 3 pages of how, you know, agonizing this has been, how Jeremy turned up on her a sandwich and let her stay untied for half an hour. Still no word on the toilet situation. Mm. And he wouldn't stay with her and wouldn't let, I guess he's staying in the cabin because she begged him to let her stay in his room. But he said,
I'd say that's the hotel room that he's staying in, probably in town, isn't it?
I guess. But then I was wondering, I mean, we did wonder that last time. But anyway, he's the long and short of it is he won't let her out of the cabin and basically realizes she's been a fool.
Yes. Yeah. She's just like, what have I gotten myself into? This guy is terrible. All he cares about money. And she's like blaming herself. Her mother tried to warn her all this time. And so she's just like, he's definitely gone too far at this stage. So she's like, right, OK, well, I'm not going through with this plan anymore. He can do whatever he wants and he can take the money for all she cares at this stage. But he's going to have to get it himself because Sue decides she is officially out.
We cut to Sweet Valley High, where Lila basically grabs Todd out of study hall and she's faked a note to get off school and Todd, of course, hasn't. But they have to bunk off because they have important errands to do, including picking up a disguise for Lila at the costume store.
Yes.
So they like skulk down the corridors and then Lila just jumps into the girls' loo because Chrome Dome is approaching. Apparently Chrome Dome is now like a million years old because we're told he's shuffling down the hall towards Todd, the fluorescent lights of the ceiling reflecting off his bald head.
Poor old Chrome Dome, he's really well past retirement age the way it sounds here.
Well, Todd runs after Lila into the girls' loo and Olivia, for some insane reason, greets her with a wrenching scream at the sight of her actual friend in a toilet in the middle of the day.
I know, she really overdoes it. It doesn't seem like Olivia as well. Like, none of this seems like Olivia because they describe her like standing in front of the mirror with like lipstick poised in front of her face. And it's like, no, this isn't Olivia. What are you talking about?
No. So Lila is sitting on the counter. Again, Olivia wasn't even on her own when somebody burst in. So I don't know why she's so shocked, but they run off and Todd is worried someone has heard Olivia scream, rightly so, seeing his Chrome Dome was probably just outside the door. So they run out and jump in the car.
Make their getaway.
Yes. Well, meanwhile, back at the casa, Alice is preparing a salad and Liz can't understand why everybody is acting normally. Like Jessica and Jeremy are lying together and like by the pool and, just acting like nothing's wrong. And I don't know, maybe Alice is going mad because this meal she is making sounds fucking deranged.
I don't know what she's doing because she's listing off a bunch of vegetables because she's going to make a salad and then she's just piling grapes into a bowl. But like, she's kind of going on about cold cuts as well, because they're getting some kind of meal on the go anyway. Yeah. When she asks Liz to set the table, she turns around from the fridge with like two loaves of bread, a bag of turnips, a head of lettuce, a carton of milk and a jar of mustard. And I'm just like, Liz and Alice, what is going on here? Like, where are you going with the bag of fucking turnips?
Turnips are huge.
Turnips are enormous. Like, what is she doing? Time for your turnip sandwich and your pint of milk. Like,
are turnips something else in America? Like, I thought that Americans called what we call turnips Swedes. Oh, or is that parsnips? But anyway, they're basically big, like solid,
big
yolks,
fucking
like
root
a
vegetable.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, a turnip is massive. A bag of turnips, like, thrown over her shoulder. Like, where are you going with a bag of turnips? I'm baffled by this lunch / dinner, whatever they're having. It makes absolutely no sense.
Well, listeners, I mean, if there is something we're missing about this, are you like, this is the recipe, the very normal recipe for like a Chattanooga salad, and it's a completely standard American dish.
The classic Chattanooga salad, of course, four turnips at least.
Maybe it's served in a hollowed out turnip. Who knows?
Ooh, maybe it's like a Halloween dish and they do like an old timey jack-o'-lantern like we used to do here, carving turnips like fools.
Well, Liz is getting worried, not because of Alice making a meal that seems to be majority turnip. It's because her obsessive behavior reminds her of, we're told, another unhappy time when she sort of turned into a separate wife during Liz's trial.
Yeah.
And she offers to help with the chores, and Alice doesn't assuage her worries because she starts like grabbing an electric broom. I mean, I'm not sure what an electric broom is. It's like one of those carpet sweepers. Anyway, yeah. She's running it back and forth on the immaculate Spanish tiled floor. But somehow Liz reassures herself that Alice has not actually lost her mind.
She hasn't checked out again like she did before, because apparently she can see anguish in her mother's eyes. So she's like, oh, okay, good. That's fine.
She's relieved her mother is facing reality.
Mm-hmm.
So outside, Jessica is basically writhing around like a beach whale to impress Jeremy. But sadly, it's not working.
Oh, she's just, yeah, she's doing her best to get his attention, but it is not really going to plan. She's just like, she's just like, lying beside him, just like squirming because, you know, of the hot sun or whatever. But he's just like, huh, what? Just totally not paying her the slightest bit of attention. And she's like, oh, what's the matter? And he's like, oh, nothing, I'm just worried about Sue. And she's like, ah, fucking Sue. So she gets up and does like a big fancy dive into the pool, makes a big show of like posing at the end of the diving board before she goes in and everything. Like, it's pretty gas, to be honest.
It is. Especially as we're told she's determined to make him notice her. Like, yeah. I cannot believe this bitch was ever criticizing Sue for supposedly being desperate. Clingy, because you put her in the halfpenny place, Jessica.
Honestly, yeah. So she's swimming across the pool and after diving in, and even like her swimming is amazing because it's all like she's swimming steadily with strong, sure strokes, because Wakefields are so fucking good at everything. Like, comes out of the pool, shakes her hair, makes a whole fucking production of the whole thing. But she comes back to the deck chairs to find Jeremy is snoring.
So she shakes her hair again to wake him up with droplets. And then she's like, she's really clutching at straws. She asks him to put on I'm going to call it sunscreen. It's probably barbecue sauce.
Their usual.
She decides he's not doing that sexily enough, so she's going to have to pull out all the stops.
Oh God, yes. So she tells him that she has something to give him and silently hands him a small square box. And Jeremy, quite understandably, is like, what the fuck is this? Because he opens the box to find like a gold ring in it. So he's like, oh my God, you shouldn't have. This must have cost a fortune. And Jess reveals that it's Stephen's ring from when he was engaged to Kara Walker. He thought we should have it. Stephen hadn't actually given her permission to have the ring, but Jessica was sure he wouldn't notice its absence. So she basically stole Stephen's, I guess, intended wedding ring from when he was going to marry
her.
And now she's giving it to Jeremy. Like, this is a shit show.
She tells Jeremy it's Stephen's from a cancelled wedding. I mean, I guess that's, cancelled weddings are like their thing now.
It's like their, yeah, it's like their love language is cancelled. Take this cursed ring.
Also, why is she giving it to him now? It is clearly a wedding ring. It's like a gold band. Why are you giving it to him 2 years before your supposed nuptials?
Because everyone's insane in these books.
Okay, that could be the answer to most of our questions. Yeah. We are also told she is desperate, she sure fucking is, to forge the bond that seemed to be rapidly disappearing between her and Jeremy. Mm-hmm. And you know, she judges Sue. My God, the hypocrisy of it.
Absolutely heck of her.
But it doesn't fit his ring finger.
Oh no. So yeah, he puts it on his pinky finger and he says it's even more special this way. So she's just relieved that he's accepted her gift, stolen gift. And she's just delighted and just looks at how hot he is. And she's like, oh, Jeremy, I love you. So he says he loves her too, more than anything in the world. And this is, I suppose, what she was kind of looking for, basically, was to actually have his attention, get him to say these things to her. So she's happy for now.
Well, we cut to Sweet Valley High. For some reason, this is where Todd and Lila, having bugged off school, have chosen to meet Robbie and his cousin Cindy.
Oh my God, you're so right. In the car park. I'd say, for God's sake, lads, plan better. At least go to the Dairy Burger car park or something. Honestly, amateur hour.
Well, they may be amateur hour, but they're putting the work in because apparently they're on their way, or they will be in a second, to the Sweet Valley power plant to get uniforms. And they are outfitted for the occasion as young executives.
Oh, yes, they are.
Young executives. Bear in mind, these children are fucking 16. How young are the executives in Sweet Valley?
Oh my God. Yeah, because like this is the whole plan. Like it's, yeah, they're going to be coming in as executives. Like we're business people. Fucking Vincent Adultman doing a business. Like very fucking that. I just feel like they're all just wearing their parents' clothes or something.
Oh, 100%. So Robbie arrives and of course makes time for some stupid banter, which I cannot be arsed trans, you know, sharing with you. Yes. Yeah. So they meet Cindy, the cousin, who is of course a hunk.
Of course.
Though he's more of a sharp dresser than his cousin, as I guess befits the vice president of Sweet Valley Power.
Sure, look, why not? Let's promote these children. They work hard enough.
No wonder they have young executives who are still in school.
This all makes perfect sense.
So they arrive at Sweet Valley Power, and Lila, despite the fact that I guess they're probably within sight of the security guards, basically snogs Robbie like at the window. And they head in with Cindy as their guests. And he sort of puts on a show of, you know, like, look, here was our amazing power room.
Yeah, like he's giving a tour to potential clients, whatever that's all about. But yeah, this is the kind of the cover story.
Yeah. And then they sneak off to the fourth floor. And this is where apparently the supplies are kept. So the plan is that Lila will go into this stock room thing. And Todd and Sydney will stand guard and stop somebody going in. Yes. This is so contrived. Lila goes into the stock room, after she comes in and somebody else starts opening the door, so she has to hide under a pile of clothes because I guess they keep all the dirty linen just in piles in this room. She doesn't get caught. So that tension was completely contrived. And when she comes out, she understandably says, you were meant to be lookouts. Why didn't you stop this intruder? And they're like, oh, you said it was an emergency. So Todd says Lila saved the day with her quick thinking. And she acts like she came up with some amazing plan as opposed to hiding under a, I don't know, an old overall.
Smelly jumpsuit? I don't know. Like, it's all a load of nothing. Basically, she gets the uniforms is what's happened here, but they just really fucking draw it out.
Oh my God. It is like pages and pages of this. Like
unnecessary.
I described it in too much detail there, and I left out a lot.
So much.
So we cut back to the casa where Jeremy and Jessica are making chit chat, and Liz again can't understand why they're acting like nothing's wrong. And Liz isn't hungry, but then Ned returns and he's pretty cheerful and sassy, and he's got a little attaché case.
He does. He's like waving his hand. He's like doing little flourishes. He is living it up here because he pops open the briefcase and they all gather around. So when he lifts the cover, they see that it's stacked full of cash, stacks of crisp green bills. And everyone is like amazed at the sight of so much money. Jessica is like, oh my God, it's like the movies. And Liz is like, unfortunately, this is real life, Jess. It's like, oh God, all right, Liz. God forbid you ever enjoy yourself. But yeah, so Ned takes out the money, kind of starts counting it, just like arranging it all in piles of like $100,000 each. And then Jeremy...
That's five piles. That's just five piles.
Oh no, six. Because remember, the ransom went up.
Sorry, six whole piles.
That's right. You do what Cookie Monster says. Jeremy decides to help. So he starts pulling out bills. And Liz notices him pick up a wad of bills, seeming to waft the print under his nose. Liz is like, he's smelling the money. He wants to make sure it's real. And Liz, like, for a fleeting moment, thought she detected a self-satisfied smirk on Jeremy's face. But then it's like gone as soon as it appeared. So she's like, oh, I guess that's nothing anyway. He's not acting suspiciously at all. This is fine.
Like the way he wasn't acting suspiciously earlier in this very book when he was like, no, let's not use the phone now. Oh, look, just, it's ringing.
Oh, look at that. Let me just stall for no reason. And I was literally standing there sniffing the money like, this guy, zero chill.
So Ned announces he's going to put the money in the safety deposit box, and he wants to have a little chat with Sam in the study. So they all head off, and Liz is, in fairness, genuinely suspicious of Jeremy, though. She doesn't go so far as to think he's the kidnapper, but no. She wonders, is he hoping that it is fake so he can like claim Sue and her fortune? But anyway, he's just not acting like he's worried about Sue, and he's not acting like he's worried about her losing her inheritance. But Jeremy is, I mean, for all his suspicious action, he's sort of almost trying to like confront Liz.
He's very brazen, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes.
Liz looks at him and he just kind of stares back at her and then just kind of starts talking to Jessica about going for another dip in the pool or something. So yeah, he's very much kind of just trying to brazen this whole thing out. But I suppose Liz, yeah, she is getting slightly suspicious, but like not as much as she should be, because he was literally smelling the money like a weirdo.
So meanwhile, Lila and Go are about to steal a fucking truck. So they basically arrive at the garage. Lila hides under a coat and Sydney flashes his card to the superintendent. And why, if Sydney is so important, does he just not requisition a truck? Or like, why do they have to steal it? What is happening?
It's so silly because he has the two lads in the back in their like overalls. So they look like workmen. And like, it's just so unnecessary. As you say, he's a fucking vice president apparently in there. And yet he's like having to do all this subterfuge to just get a fucking truck out of the lot. Like, come on. People, please.
There's also a completely ridiculous and properly weird, we spoke last week or last time about the sort of odd feverish tone of this book where they reach a truck and he goes, ain't she a beauty? And Lila goes, aren't you sweet? She said, Lila, popping up at Sydney's words.
And Robbie's under a coat.
And Robbie is still looking at the truck and is going, she sure is, we're told. Muttered Lila, like she's genuinely offended that they weren't randomly praising her charms.
It's just, yeah, the tone is just all over the shop, like with these books. It's just nobody's making any sense at all.
They just have a stupid slapstick moment where Todd's overalls fall down because they're too big and they show off his boxers.
Pretty much, yeah. It's weird. Like they're going to this, like, as far as they know, they're like trying to rescue hostages, and yet they're all like falling over and having all these stupid slapstick moments. And I'm just like, what's happening?
Yeah, like they care enough. They take this situation seriously enough to form a sort of rescue gag, but then they're still sort of like, wah, wah, wah.
Fucking Three Stooges. Like,
oh my gosh, I refer strange. To them as the Three Stooges for the rest of my notes.
Accurate.
Why I yada.
Basically, yeah, that is the vibe. It's yeah. like, you can take this seriously or don't.
Well, back at the castle, the twins are getting wired for sound, and Jessica's complaining about the whole procedure, and Liz is not impressed, and they're acting like children, basically. Yeah. They're just squabbling with each other. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, Jeremy is getting impatient.
He is, because he doesn't know the details of this whole situation yet, because I guess it's all very secretive, the plan. So he hasn't been filled in, I guess, on the whole thing, because he's kind of watching the two girls being wired, and it's like he's anxious to find out the details for the evening's drop-off, because they've convened apparently in the den after lunch to go over everything. But like, yeah, he just wants them, I suppose, to get going as well, because he's like, okay, I need to you know, to do something, because he's just sitting there trying not to be suspicious and failing. So eventually Sam reveals the plan, and like Jeremy leans in closely to hear as she's starting to explain.
Yes.
Go on.
Could you imagine it?
So the twins are going to take the money in the Jeep, make the drop at this gas station. They'll pick up Sue, and Sam is going to follow behind from a safe distance. Alice is kind of like, oh, I don't know about this. Like, my children are being used as bait. I'm not convinced. But Ned is like, it's fine. It's like, Sam will be right behind them. It'll be grand. So it's all very like, yeah, they're fine, whatever. But also, this is nothing new for the twins. They've been through so much at this stage. Surely they're just like, yeah, this is a fucking walk in the park, lads. All I should do is bring a briefcase somewhere. Grand. No bother.
I love that they're having, well, I don't love. I love in one way that they're having lots of, you know, references to past events, like Carl the Orderly. And, you know, there's a reference later on to like, don't go home with John. Like, they're really trying to show in some way that they've read previous books.
This is the same series, believe it or not. Yeah,
but also no reference to the whole pour it out for Margot, because like, surely that's their most recent
trauma.
Dice with death. Well, I mean, the werewolf thing is, but I guess Alice doesn't know about that.
Oh, yeah.
Or does she? Who knows?
Who knows? Honestly.
So maybe she does. I don't know. Oh, I guess they've had so many traumas that, you know, this is just one more.
Just add it to the pile. We'll figure it out later, I guess. Oh my God. But anyway, yes. So apparently when Sue is safely in the Jeep with the twins, then Sam is going to contact the authorities on her car phone and go after the kidnapper herself. So it's like, okay. All right, Sam, I guess. But Jeremy's delighted to hear this, because he reckons Sam Diamond's plan is going to fit right into his.
So Jeremy makes his own super quick plans. So he decides he's going to block the tailpipe of Sam's car so her engine doesn't work. And then he'll don his disguise and follow the twins to the drop.
That makes it sound like he's going to pull on a blonde wig and a white Chanel suit. It's me, Sam Diamond.
Drive and die. But it's quite dramatic. He's going to run them off the road, not enough to hurt them, just enough to make them stop the car. That is, I mean, you'd want to be a fucking stunt driver to be able to, on this.
He's putting a lot of faith in his driving skills here. It's like, yeah, not enough to hurt them. It'll be fine. If it flips over, so be it.
Well, while they're halted on the shoulder, the hard shoulder, I guess, he'll jump out and grab the briefcase. And while the detective is checking out the wreck, he would make his getaway. And he thinks, and then he would be a rich man, thought Jeremy with glee. A very rich man. I mean, not that rich.
Moderately rich man.
You could buy a 3-bedroom semi in a Dublin suburb.
And you still have to work, Jeremy. You still have to go back to Project Nature.
I mean, I can't believe he hasn't been fired, seeing as he wasn't there in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
So later, the twins get ready to set out. Jessica, who clearly hasn't seen Thelma and Louise, which did play a significant role in a recent episode of the TV series that we watched.
That's so funny that keeps happening.
It really does. We kind of encounter the little synergy moments.
Yeah.
But anyway, Jessica says, we're like, Thelma and Louise, two renegades. Like, what? Did you watch it?
What are you talking about?
Do you remember the ending? Yeah. Liz in the TV series did remember the ending, so that's that.
Well, there's that too, yeah. But yeah, Liz is like so anxious, she's just not really in the form for any of this. She's like, we're not the outlaws, we're the victims. And Jessica kind of makes fun of her for being so worried. But like Jessica is so chill about this. She's like, oh, get into the spirit of things. It's exciting. We're like Mata Hari out on a secret mission.
Didn't she end up executed as well? Like
she did, yes. Very true. Not a great reference point there, Jess. But yeah, like she's just so chill about like driving around with like over $500,000 in the car. Like I had to get money out once to like pay a builder. I had to get $2,000 out of the bank and I had to get Angus to like walk me across the road back to the car because I just did not want to be outside with that much money on me. Like, and Jess is just like, this is great crack. Went around with my like $600,000. Like, what are you doing?
She's also, I mean, you'll describe it later, but she is dressed outrageously. And she apparently thinks she's being discreet, but Jeremy says, I don't know, you'd probably draw everybody's attention to yourself as soon as you pull into the gas station. In fact, I think you look too sexy to go out in the road. You might get stopped for distracting motorists. Like, are they demolished in the room while this bat is perving on a child?
Honestly, I like, at the very least, we know Liz is there, but like, yeah, they're waiting by the front door. Like, yeah, I feel like everyone is in the room and Jeremy is just perving on this child. And it's just like, why has nobody just booted this man off a cliff?
Well, Jessica says, nothing suits me better than danger and intrigue. Very normal teenage girl dialogue.
Totally.
And she thinks, actually, nothing suited her better than being the center of attention with an adoring man by her side.
Gross.
Sickening.
I hate it.
So then Ned, I guess he was there the whole time, gives Liz the briefcase and it's time to go. And Alice gets so melodramatic. My notes just say, calm the fuck down, Alice.
Oh my God. She goes full like TV movie. She's like, my girls, my darling twin girls, and like pulls them both into a hug. And it's just like, Alice, where has all this energy been for the last 109 books, pray tell?
Tears, we're told, fell unabated down her cheeks.
Hilarious. Oh my God. But the twins like reassure her that it's all going to be fine and they have to go now. She's like, oh, be careful. But on their way out, Jessica notices apparently Amy Sutton just like left her camcorder at the casa. It's the one that she used to make her film for Video Club. So yeah, she had obviously left it behind at some point. So Jess at the last minute thinks, well, this might be handy. So she grabs it as they're heading out the door.
So we cut to the Three Stooges heading to the rescue with Todd at the wheel. Like he's driving all over the place because he doesn't know how to drive a truck. It is ridiculous. And Lila says she feels like she's a kid on a roller coaster ride. And Robbie says, you look like a man in uniform. And I don't think it's spoiling an outfit, Karen. No,
We simply have to explain why. Yes, because Lila has fastened a fake moustache to her upper lip and pulled her hair back in a white painter's cap. So they're all wearing the Sweet Valley Power uniforms and they've smudged their faces with dirt to conceal their identities. Like,
what? They dressed as chimney sweeps in Mary Poppins. Like, why does Lila think it's more likely that there would be a fake moustache wearing than a female electrician?
Yeah. Oh my God, all of this. But just the dirt on the face is so funny. It's
amazing.
You think you're coal miners? What? Chimney sweeps? Like, clean chimney, Gavna. What are you doing? What is this?
Jim Giroux.
Yes, exactly.
Well, they arrive at their destination and Lila is armed with the fire extinguisher and the others have, you know, various bits and bobs.
Bits and pieces, yeah.
So we cut to Jeremy's POV. The girls leave and he wants to run after them straight away, but he restrains himself. And of course, when he does spring into action, he's subtle as a brick as usual.
Christ. Yeah, he like slaps his hand to his forehead as if struck by an idea. And he's like, oh, I know. I'll wait in the nature cabin. That way I'll be close to the action if there's any problems. And Ned is like mid-sentence. He's like, oh, good idea. Why don't I come? But Jeremy's already like running out the door. He's literally sprinting across the lawn before Ned can join him. And then yanks a wool ski mask out of his pocket and puts it on his face as he ran. So surely Ned and Alice are standing there going, what the fuck is Jeremy doing? Why is he belting it across the lawn and pulling on a balaclava? Like, what's happening here?
And also, it's like the middle of the day, as far as I know. So all the neighbors will see him like sprinting across the lawn, as you say, putting a balaclava on his head. Like, this is just bizarre on so many levels.
Hilarious.
Oh, no, hang on. It isn't broad daylight, even I guess it is winter, so okay, it's getting so dark, it's earlier. But oh, they have street lamps and people will be awake. It's not late. Because Todd notices a mysterious stranger run out of the house and, very conveniently for the plot, disappear into the darkness.
Ooh.
So after all the very detailed plotting, Todd is like, forget the plan, let's get him.
Let's get this guy. So yeah, Robbie and Todd basically tackle him. It takes a few goes, I think, but they eventually manage to hold down the kidnapper. Lila sprays him with the fire extinguisher. It's a whole thing. And then Robbie leans over and pulls the ski mask off and he's like, Jeremy. And Jeremy is furious. His face is purple with rage. He's like covered in, I guess, whatever the spray stuff was. Yeah. He's drenched. He looks ridiculous. Like, he's been completely drenched and soaked by the fire extinguisher. Lila's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, we didn't mean to get you. Todd's like, oh yeah, sorry about that. And they're all just like apologetic. And Jeremy's like, get out of my way, would you? And like runs off. And Todd's like, it was just an accident. But also, why is no one like, what the fuck was Jeremy doing just now? Because they're like, oh, I guess it was a Halloween costume.
For like, fuck's sake. Like,
it's
genuinely, they're the stupidest people alive. Because, like, the fact that they do wonder about the ski mask and they're just like, maybe you wanted to scare Jessica or something. Like,
oh my God.
What? I mean, seconds ago, you thought they were held hostage. Okay, you know, like, also, do you remember that shadowy figure you saw in the room, Lila? Any ring any bells now?
No. Are we putting anything together? Perhaps two and maybe another two? No? Okay.
No. Oh, heaven forfend. So Ned and Alice come out and are like, what the fuck is happening? And they're, the Three Stooges are stunned, we're told, to see the Wakefields waltzing out onto their lawn unharmed. And Lila's like, oh, hi, Mr. and Mrs. Wakefield. And Ned says, Lila, is that you? And yeah, it's me, said Lila with a sigh.
So resigned.
Ned and Alice are basically like, why the fuck are you in disguise?
What's happening? And who is this Sweet Valley power worker that's with you? So Lila introduces her boyfriend, Robbie. And they're like, so what the fuck is going on? Why do you have all this equipment and a truck and like all this stuff and uniforms, the whole lot? So Todd explains that they thought that the Wakefields were being held hostage.
Yeah.
So he's fuming with Lila because he's like, oh God, this is like, everything had clearly been fine all along and this was some stupid thing that Jessica made up probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he kind of tries to explain, but then yeah, Lila kind of cuts in because he's about to explain and then gets worried he's going to get Jessica or Liz in trouble for saying something they shouldn't have. But anyway, Lila eventually explains why they thought that they were being held hostage. And, so it's, oh God, it's so stupid.
And Alice invites them in to explain why they turned up in uniforms and a truck and a false moustache.
Mm-hmm.
And says, but Lila, don't you think you should take off that moustache first? I mean, I can't believe we've had so many fake moustaches in the last like 6 books.
Brilliant.
Way more than I thought we'd have ever.
You just never know what's going to happen with this series.
You sure don't. Well, we cut to a very angry Jeremy racing down the road to the drop-off point. And you know he's angry because he cries, darn it!
Ooh, that's the most angry anyone can ever be.
So he knows he's too late to like run them off the road. That's not risky at all plan. Mm-hmm. But then he gets another idea.
Yes, he realizes he's going to have to get Sue involved and he's going to have to complicate things more than he would have liked.
Oh, Christ.
But apparently it can still work. So like very subtly, he like revs the engine, backs up rapidly around the building, wheels screeching as he turned onto the road. And apparently the twins are just sat there not noticing any of this. So he heads for the cabin and for Sue while the twins are kind of waiting there to complete the drop off.
Also, isn't he using his own rental car that they presumably know? Like, seriously, criminal mastermind he is not.
Definitely not.
Well, we cut to the cabin and poor old Sue, the big Egypt, as my notes say. Apparently she's been tied to a chair literally all day. It's now evening. She's weak with hunger. She's also almost certainly has wet herself. And Jeremy bellows, Sue! And slams the door behind him so hard when he walks in that a picture falls off the wall.
it's cartoonish. Like, this is just so ridiculous.
It gets even more cartoonish with Sue's response to him.
Oh God, like he... Yeah, she has to like stuff the bandana back into her mouth and she's like, calling from the attic. So he stomps up to find her. Poor Sue is like cowering because he's so cross. And he kind of unties her and he's like, come on, relate. And she's like, what's going on? What's happened? So he kind of pulls her out of the chair and poor Sue like collapses on the floor because she's been tied to the fucking chair for like day and night for who knows how long.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's really bad. And he kind of is a little bit nice to her then and is like, oh, do you think you can make it? And then is immediately horrible again. But yeah, Sue just says, look, I can't do this. Like, I don't want to do this. This has gone too far. I'll just tell people I was lost or kidnapped or whatever. We'll go back to New York, get on with our lives. But Jeremy is simply not having it. He's like, look, it's too late. And when she says that, like, he can get the money whatever way he wants, but she's not going to be involved, he's just like, you know, I can't do this without you. You know that. So he just forces her into the car, basically, and just kind of like yells at her until she just goes along with the plan as intended. Because, like, she just, she can't really stand up to him because he is quite scary.
Is scary.
Like, yeah, he is, in fairness.
At one stage, we're told his tone was menacing and his eyes were glazed.
Oh,
and
he, that's like, very creepy.
Yanks her to her feet and sort of pushes her into the car, like, literally shoves her into the car. So, like, he is.
It's bad.
It's properly aggressive. Mm-hmm. And they drive back to the drop-off point, and Sue is really upset, and he is, again, really actively angry and threatening. He's like, would you stop your bawling? He asks in disgust. And then he goes, well, this is the lady rescue time.
Oh my God. He shoves her out of the car and, like, poor Sue, she kind of stumbles out, like hobbles across the gravel. And then he kind of jumps out and goes to her and is being kind of nice again. So he's really,
it's
like,
really abusery. It's like, it's horrible.
So, it's awful. Like, he's really just like turning on a dime here. Like, it's just real, like, disconcerting the whole way through. So then Sue is kind of being all apologetic and she's like, oh, I didn't mean to betray you. And he's like, oh, that's okay, sweetheart. And then he's like, okay, look, this is the plan. Look, I'll pick you up at 8 from the Wakefields tonight. We'll make our getaway. Do you think you can do that? And he reassures her that this time tomorrow they'll be safe and sound in Mexico. So Sue just kind of just has been like beaten down at this stage and is like, yeah, okay. And like smiles weakly at him, but is basically going to go along with it. So,
yeah. Poor Sue. Her resolution did not last long.
Sure didn't. Yeah.
So we cut to Liz's POV and I don't really understand where exactly Jeremy's parked the car or anything. But anyway, the twins arrive, even though Jeremy had time, despite being behind them, to like go up to the cabin, get Sue, drive back again.
I think they've been sitting at the station this whole time, just waiting for Sue to appear, basically.
But where is Jeremy? Like, where has he parked the car? What's happening?
There's any number of buildings, I guess, that he could peel away so loudly earlier undetected. Like, who even knows?
So Sue is a wreck, apparently. Still in her witch costume.
Yes.
But she seems unharmed. And Jessica's like, she looks like she's been through a war. And Liz says, she has.
Oh my God.
So Sue was just standing there. And then I guess Liz has to drop off the suitcase before. I don't understand why, if Sue was just standing there on her own, Sue just doesn't run over to them. But
yeah, that's
maybe they think the kidnapper has a gun. I don't know.
Who knows?
So I was quite confused when I read this because I was like, oh, so Sue is there. So why is Liz dropping the money off?
Surely why don't they just
drop,
like,
the money off and then Sue appears? Yeah.
You would think, but look, again, we have come to the wrong place for any kind of sense or reason.
Yeah, true. So she drops off the case and she backs out quickly. And then at that moment, a man darted in from nowhere and grabbed the briefcase. So he's like, she's right there. She could see him.
Where did he come from?
I don't know.
Like, it's like as she leaves the, like, it's a telephone booth. He popped right in after her and just stands there. Like, oh, it's so stupid. But anyway, Liz, when she sees him, runs back to the car because she's freaked out. But like, as they're sitting there watching this guy, he's like standing in the phone booth counting the money and then heads off. And they're just like, okay, that was weird. But also,
he's got a very elaborate outfit and I am wondering where he acquired it.
He did get his hat. Because he's wearing a hat and like a trench coat or something. And he did get the hat in the cabin. He grabbed that on his way out while he was being horrible to see. So at least one part of it, we know where it came from.
Fair enough. He has a red bandana as well, which I guess is Sue's bandana.
Oh, yeah.
the gag bandana.
Of course, yes.
But one crucial thing about this scene is that Jessica has filmed the whole thing with Amy's video camera.
Yes.
So, the mystery man clicks the briefcase shut, leaves the phone booth, and then Sue hobbles across to the Jeep as soon as he leaves.
Yeah.
And the twins rush over to her, and Sam finally turns up as the twins are, Liz is consoling Sue, and Sam reveals why she was late.
Yeah, because she's actually in Ned's car and reveals that somebody stuffed a rag in the tailpipe of her car so the engine wouldn't start. So that's why she had to take Ned's car. But obviously she just lost time figuring out what the problem was in the first place. So she's like, whoever he is, he's smart. And that is debatable.
certainly is.
So of course, Sue has no idea who this woman is. So Liz explains that this is the private detective who's been working on the case. So Sam is like, okay, did you manage to do the drop? And Liz is like, yeah, everything went according to plan. But then Jessica's like, yeah, except the kidnapper got away. But Sam's like, look, you're all safe and that's what's important. All's not lost. And then Jessica's like, yeah, but $600,000 are lost. And Sam is like, oh, I don't think that's really a problem. And Jessica's like, why? And Liz is like, but that was Sue's entire inheritance. And then Sam reveals the money was fake.
It sure was. Apparently Ned got counterfeit bills from the bank for the occasion. Is that how it works? Banks provide them? I don't know. Under my authorization, because I guess Sam, like Judge Dredd, is the law.
Honest to God, I was like, Sam, what fucking authorization? You are a private detective, and what bank just has over $500,000 in counterfeit money that they just hand over to the least competent lawyer in Southern California on an afternoon at random? Like, this whole thing is nonsense.
I bet the bank were like, you didn't get another job offer in San Francisco, Ned, did you?
Oh my gosh, just like, oh, it's Ned. Oh, just give him the fake money. Just get him out of here. Can't be listening to him. Well, lawyer. Yes, Ned.
Yes, but you are.
Doing a great job, buddy.
Well, Liz notices when they hear about the fake cash that Sue is smiling for the first time since the rescue. Uh-huh. They all return to the casa where they find the three stooges are still there, and Liz and Todd have an emotional reunion, and then of course she's like, what are you wearing? But Alice is overjoyed to see everybody safe. Tears of joy stream down her face. And Ned, with mock sternness, is like, I'm not going to get kidnapped again. And Sue's like, I'll do my best not to, Mr. Wakefield. And that is quite a challenge in this town, given how many people have been kidnapped.
Honestly,
so
like, yeah, he's joking, but this is serious business. Because, you know, you just never know what's going to happen in this town.
Well, Jessica is wondering where Jeremy is. And of course, she's enraged by the joy of others, as usual.
As usual. As per fucking usual. Just furious.
We're told the happy family reunion was beginning to irritate her.
She's aggravated by the merriment around her. She's just such a dour bitch. I kind of love it.
So she asks where Jeremy is, and Alice says he went to the cabin because he wanted to be closer to the action for no real practical purpose whatsoever.
None.
And Jessica rings the cabin because she has the number
of the cell phone, because it doesn't have a landline, as we established earlier. Oh, look,
how does she have this number?
Honestly,
there's so many plot holes. It's seriously, it is ridiculous. So Alice was making cocoa and cake. That's a lot of sugar. And everyone gathers in the kitchen, and Jessica strolls in and goes, well, it's a regular shindig, isn't it? Like, okay, Barbara Stanwyck. This is so unlike Jessica.
Completely. Like, she's stalking in, doing her femme fatale thing to like a family party in the kitchen.
Well, Ned, understandably, has turned to drink.
Oh God! Yes, actually, he is pouring wine for himself and Alice. So they're all eating cake, having a party. This is what they do when people get kidnapped and are then rescued, isn't it? They have parties.
Oh, they did. I'm pretty sure they did when Liz came back. It was like, drama? What drama? Let's just have a party.
House party. And that's where she met Nicholas Morrow. Like, there must be a Sweet Valley Bakery doing a great line in like, congratulations on your rescue cakes.
I mean, it's a niche market, but they're in the right place.
Oh, absolutely. They know their audience.
So the girls tell everyone what happened at the drop-off, and Sue shows she's just as chill as Jeremy, because Jessica says, "We've just got to identify the kidnapper. Unfortunately, we've got it all on tape." And then Sue chokes on her cake and drops her fork.
Brilliant. Oh my God. Just no one can have like the slightest bit of chill at all, ever.
Ever. Oh. Well, Jessica is typically sensitive because Sue is just like, you know, not meeting anyone's eye, just like concentrating on her cake feasting. Mm-hmm. And Jessica's like, "Hey, Sue, did the kidnapper starve you or what?" And it's like, Jessica can be so insensitive sometimes.
Sometimes.
Every single minute of her entire life.
Oh,
and then Sue was like, "Almost. He gave me bread in the morning and some water during the day." No indication that this makes Jessica feel a smidgen of guilt for her tribe.
Not even a little bit. Yeah, so Alice basically is just like, more cake for Sue, give her more cake. But yeah, like it's, they kind of go through like how terrible things were for Sue, and then Liz is like, "I know what that's like," remembering her experience as a prisoner in Carl's cabin when she had been kidnapped. Like, not about you, Liz, okay? Your kidnapping is old news, get over it.
We've had at least two kidnappings since then, Liz, come on.
Yeah, keep up.
So they all ask Sue about the kidnapper and, you know, whether she saw any identifying things. But she says no, she never even saw his face. She was blindfolded the whole time. And Ned is confident that now they have him on tape, they'll figure him out. Yeah. And then proposes a toast. And they're all really sort of jolly. Like, literally, he's like, you know, to Liz for successfully completing the drop-off, to Jessica for fearlessly taping the event, Lila, Todd and Bobby for their courageous rescue attempt, and most of all to Sue for her bravery in the face of this ordeal. And Ned chimes in, "Hail, hail, the conquering heroes!" And they all laugh. It's like, trauma? What trauma?
It's such a weird fucking vibe. It's like you've literally just, like, saved somebody from being kidnapped or, like, from being held hostage. And it's like, do you want to maybe just bring her to hospital and have her checked over and make sure she's not, you know, severely injured / dehydrated, fucking has rabies from bats, which we learned obviously could happen. Like, it's just, it's such a weird reaction to, like, rescuing somebody. It's just like, let's have a party with some cake.
Also, they don't call the police.
No.
Even though Sue was back. Now, I did just today have a look at my copy of the next book, which I cannot believe I paid £17 sterling, which is more like considerably more in euros and plus postage, and it does actually have a reference to the police coming, presumably like hours after this book ends. But yeah, it's completely insane that, like, now Sue's safe and sound, they don't go, "Okay, we better get the police straight away after this kidnapper that we have on video." Let's just eat loads of cake.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, the Three Stooges explain their elaborate rescue plan. And while they're bagging on and we get a full recap, Liz notices there's something a bit off about Sue.
Yeah, because where everyone else is like so entertained by this amazing story and how fucking hilarious everybody is, Sue is just kind of watching the door, looking at her watch. She's just really kind of, there's something weird going on with Sue. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a moment. Now, I don't know if this was meant to imply Jessica was suspicious, because Lila reveals that when she looked in the window, she thought Jeremy was the kidnapper, and Jessica looks sort of uncomfortable. And Liz assumes that it's because, you know, Jessica's been caught out for blabbing about the hostage situation.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So is that meant to be the case, or is it because Jessica's like, maybe Jeremy could be the kidnapper? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
It's a weird detail if it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
So Liz thinks, "Oh well, you know, might as well have guessed Jessica would tell somebody, and at least one thing would always be consistent. Jessica would always be Jessica."
Yeah, except she isn't, because she's not like herself at all.
Exactly. Like, what about the other ways in which she's behaving out of character?
Oh God.
Well, later, the Three Stooges go, and the Wakefields and Sue are watching the video, and Jessica, again, a massive freak. She was talking, I think it was earlier in this book, about how, like, the twins are so hot, they could be models. And then she lets out a whistle when Elizabeth appears on screen and says, "Wow, Liz, you're pretty photogenic."
Oh, God. Well, you know, Stephen's not around to perv on, so she's got to put that attention somewhere.
Keeping it in the family as usual, Jessica. Ugh,
so grim.
they watch the kidnapper go through the money, and Ned's like, he sure is greedy. Sam points out he can't be that professional if the money fooled him. So, like, how bad or good was this forgery? Yeah. I don't really understand why it was good enough to, like, pass the smell test.
Honestly, the bank just handed Ned stacks of Monopoly money.
Hang on, this has got Mr. Monopoly on it. Wait, instead of minute. George Washington.
Who's this guy?
Is George Washington on bills? I think
he's on dollar bills, I think.
Yes. Whoever he is, I think it probably was, I don't know, Mr. Potato Head or Mr. Monopoly on these bills, because... apparently Sam isn't impressed that they passed muster with thief. Then Jessica suggests it's an old a villain, I guess. Ugh. In the Sweet Valley universe.
Yeah, this is really weird, because Alice asks, look, does anybody recognize this guy? And Jess pipes up that he looks like John Pfeiffer, she reckons. And Liz is like, what are you talking about? Where is the resemblance? And Jess is like, well, you know, he's 6 feet tall, well-built, a man. And Liz is like, you're just saying that because you don't like him. Like, it's just a really weird little aside, isn't it? Because then it's like, Jessica then is like, oh, well, he did try to date rape my best friend.
Jesus, Lime has just been there as well.
It's so weird. But Liz is like, okay, well, that doesn't mean he kidnapped Sue. But like, nobody can really suggest anything else because they just can't. There's just no identifiers that they can figure out for this guy, and no amount of like watching it in slow-mo or like pausing every time or like going in hands at the screen it seems to do anything, because they can't pick out any kind of helpful clues at all.
The one thing that I can't believe they don't mention or look at is shoes, because if I've learned anything from books about like Cold War and World War II spycraft, is that if you're tailing somebody or you're being tailed, the hardest thing, the thing to look at is shoes, because people can change coats and hats and put things inside out, but it's really hard to change your shoes.
That's so true. And around. Yeah, that's actually, I also learned that was from like Jane Casey's most recent like murder mystery book. It was like, watch for the shoes. No one ever thinks of changing the shoes. I was like, yeah, she's right.
Well, I mean, are we meant to believe that Jeremy had a spare pair of shoes somewhere, or, you know?
Oh, please, unlikely.
Well, somehow, even though they're watching this video again and again, they don't recognize anything about the body language or anything at all about the person who they've seen every day for, you know, the last week. Liz notices that Sue is being a bit weird. Now, she does wonder that maybe watching this drop off again and again and again is a bit, you know, upsetting for her.
But apparently Sue isn't even actually looking at the TV screen, and she seems strangely preoccupied. So Liz asks her what the matter is, and Sue is really jumpy and nearly like jumps out of her skin at this question. And she's like, oh, I'm just nervous from the whole ordeal, and says she needs to go out and get some air. So she like runs out the door, grabbing like her coat and her bag. Very chill as usual from Sue. And Liz just kind of watches her go, and she's like, okay, that was weird. So Sue is outside and realizes, look, there was nothing incriminating on the tape, but she still felt really like nervous and jumpy watching it. But she's like, okay, look, this is all going to be over soon. But she reckons, look, Jeremy will be here any minute now so they can make their getaway, because within an hour they'll be on a plane to Mexico and then to Rio, far away from the Wakefields and the kidnapping and the crime.
We're also told she can't wait to leave Sweet Valley for good. She wasn't particularly thrilled about accompanying Jeremy, but she didn't have much choice at this point. She has every choice. She can let him just fuck off and have nothing to do with him ever again and keep her money. Like, I don't understand why she thinks, well, you know, I've thrown my lot in with them now, so I'm bound to him forever. Like, why doesn't she have a choice?
It's really weird. Yeah, because they do kind of just say she was, you know, in too deep to back out now. But it's like, but no, like, you totally have an opportunity here now to just like walk away from this. Like, you know, the money's fake, so he's out of here and it's grand. Like, why are you trying to meet up with him?
Yeah.
But anyway.
The stuff about it being fake, we're told, is a huge relief, because now she doesn't have the burden of guilt.
Yes.
So why doesn't she just enjoy that?
I just don't know. She just refuses to be relieved at all. But anyway, she's like pacing around, waiting for Jeremy. Apparently he's never late. And now it's like 8:15 and there's still no sign of him. But yeah, she reckons that, yeah, Jeremy will be furious when he finds that the money was fake, but he'll get over it because it was only driving them apart anyway, she reckons. And then she's like, when they got back to New York, everything would be good again. So are they going to like Mexico, then Rio, and then just like back to New York? Like, what is the plan here?
Like, are they, I mean, surely the fact that they're heading off to, you know, Latin America is meant to imply that they're sort of on the run.
Yeah, and that the plan is like live it up on the beach forever on their half a million, like, I guess. Like, it's all very, very loosey-goosey as plans go.
Very much so. But anyway, she blatantly realises the truth. A realisation, a horrible realisation, we're told. Jeremy was coming back for her, and he'd never been planning to. Well, okay, good, he's off with fake money. Yeah. He had fooled Jessica all along, and he had fooled her as well.
Oh my God.
Like, this is, you should be delighted.
This should be so, like, such good news for her. Like, my God, Sue, you were trying to get away from this man because he was horrible and scary, like, no length ago. But yeah, so she walks back into the casa. She's kind of down, although yeah, Liz kind of notices her when she comes in. Apparently, yeah, Sue has a strangely serene expression on her face.
Yeah. But,
anyway, in the meantime, they've still been like just like rewatching and rewatching this videotape to no avail. And yeah, they eventually, I don't know, watch it one more time, and they're all just talking about how there's not one possible clue.
Sam says, we'll just play it one more time. And of course, Jessica quips, play it again, Sam. And they all laugh merrily again.
Oh, Jesus, I hate everyone in this room. Oh, God. But yeah, so they're all just like lamenting the fact that they just can't seem to figure anything out from this footage. And then Jessica suddenly notices something on the tape, and it causes a sick feeling to settle into the pit of her stomach.
Yes, she doesn't join in as the others express their frustration about not being able to identify the kidnapper, because she did see a clue. A dead giveaway, in fact. The kidnapper wasn't wearing any gloves. I mean, seriously, oh my fuck's sake. Fingerprints must be all
this
over that fucking phone
fucking
box.
Guy, I swear to God.
But on the little finger of his left hand was the ring that Jessica had given him.
Oh my God, could you possibly believe it?
Now, can you read us out, or does your version have the little...
Mine doesn't have the little tagline for the next one, or the little, intro thing.
Well, mine does. And says, it says, who is Jeremy Randall really? Don't miss Sweet Valley High, number 111, A Deadly Christmas. The terrifying, I mean, I'm sure it will be, but not for the reasons that they intend, conclusion to this riveting three-part miniseries.
Oh, stop it. Oh, how dare they? Absolutely not. Oh, don't even try it, Bantam Books, you bastards. Oh my God.
I mean, this, I don't even know what, how to describe it. This sequence has definitely, I guess the Margot adventures were the longest.
Yeah, that's true.
Including the jungle prom and everything. Mm. But like, I don't think we've never had any this level of inconsistency. Like, sometimes it's five parts, sometimes it's three parts, sometimes this part of it's two parts. Like, what's happening?
I don't know. But also, like, I suppose it also feels like it's gone on forever because we've been doing two episodes per book. Oh,
that's true. It's been months.
Be like, we've always been here.
I cannot wait until Sue and Jeremy have just like sailed off into the void.
God, please.
It's seriously like, it's, I'm just tired of all of them now.
I know, same. I'm so done.
I am interested in how it all plays out, so I am looking forward to reading the last book.
In fairness, A Deadly Christmas is a pretty good title, so I am kind of excited for that, I have to say.
Well, speaking of things we're excited about, can you excite us with some stats and outfits?
Yes, I absolutely can. Okay, so the Wakefield blondness got 6 mentions.
In the whole book?
In the whole book, yes. These are whole book stats. The blue-green eyes got 5 mentions. Like, it's kind of, yeah, we definitely did better in the previous book, I feel
I mean, considering that the books are almost twice as long as they used to be.
That's it. There's so much opportunity for way more mentions of hair color and eye color. But also Jeremy is eating up some of that attention because his eye color was mentioned 3 times and his tawny blonde hair got 4 mentions. So there was that too.
Okay. So there's still a lot of blonde locks being flung around.
A lot of blondeness going on. So don't you worry. then for outfits. Oh God. Yes. So Jessica, when she's going to make the drop, her low-key outfit, not to attract any attention, consists of tight black leggings with tiny purple stars on them and a matching deep purple sweater.
Wow.
Her leggings were tucked into sleek black leather boots, and she's wearing a pair of cat-eye black sunglasses to complete the effect.
At night. Lest we forget, at night.
100% at night. Absolutely ludicrous. We find out that Todd wears blue plaid boxer shorts when his jumpsuit thing falls off and he trips over and it's all fucking ridiculous. So that was some detail that we got out.
Detail I think we could have lived without.
But you know what? We had to read it, so now everyone has to know. Jessica, when she's like squirming around on a deck chair trying to get Jeremy's attention, she's wearing an aqua string bikini that matches the colour of her eyes.
Oh, of course she is. How many swimsuits does she have? Like,
so many. Oh my God.
I have one from Dunn's.
She has a wardrobe, a whole section of that wardrobe taken up with bikinis, surely. Yeah.
Definitely. Is that it for outfits?
Oh, it is not. Okay. Ooh. Because we have... Oh,
yeah. Sorry, I've just remembered.
We have our young executives, of course. So we have Todd looking more conservative than ever in his navy blue pinstriped suit. Like, I've just decided it's double-breasted because if it's going to be pinstripe, let's go full gangster. Why not?
Oh, please.
Surely.
We got to get around TGs in somewhere.
You just have to. But honestly, the absolute icing on Alice's rescue party cake is Lila's outfit for her executive look, because she's wearing an elegant scarlet suit with a matching hat.
Where did she... I mean...
Fucking, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? She's in Sweet Valley wearing black pumps. Like, holy shit. I had to read that a few times because, like, a scarlet suit. Okay, yes, low key, I guess. Matching hat. What is happening here?
Every young executive. I mean, this is very Alexis in Dynasty. Like, it does not scream 90s to me.
Like, she is living her best Dynasty life. It is wild that this is her, like, don't attract attention, we're just some executive. Just head to toe, bright red suit, fantastic.
And a hat.
Oh, and the matching hat, like, of course, obvs, like, Jesus Christ. Where would you be going? But, like, that's,
oh my God.
That is our headliner for the outfits, and with good reason, I think.
Oh, definitely. That's quite a showstopper.
It truly is.
Well, listeners, now we've reached the end of Death Threat. Did you... Is enjoy the right word? I mean...
Endure?
What did you think? Let us know. We always absolutely love hearing from you. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at @SVHpodcast.
You can send us an email at svhpodcast@gmail.com.
And of course, we are on Instagram at @SVHpodcast, where, as mentioned earlier, several of you did let us know that Sue had a very good reason, and indeed, I guess Jessica did too, to be scared of bats.
Yeah, so rabies, obviously, just didn't occur to us because, yeah, we don't have that here.
We don't. We are one, us and the UK are like, I think, the two countries in Europe that just don't have rabies, which is why in the past people, you know, if you took your dog or cat from a rabies or any pet from a rabies country, which is most places on earth, they'd like have to be in quarantine for like 6 months, like really long time. So it doesn't strike us that like bats here, you know, maybe people are scared of them, but you're not going to catch anything off them, at least not something that's going to like kill you quite quickly.
No, yeah, so we're all good for rabies over here. So it just, yeah, did not even cross our minds.
So thank you to everybody who educated us on that one. You also had lots of thoughts on what Bruce's Porsche outfit consisted of, and they were all extremely funny.
Oh, all wonderful. Yeah, a lot of shout outs for when Joey basically wore head to toe Porsche merch in that episode of Friends. So yeah, a lot of people had that thought, or also the like children's Halloween costume that is like basically like Lightning McQueen from Cars. Yes. That's like strapped over their shoulders and they're like standing into this like little car, basically running around with that around their waist. So yeah, a lot of thoughts were that it was basically that, but with a black Porsche.
Yes, Maggie Lachat was one of quite a few who mentioned a very cute reel, which we did see, of a kid who transforms from a car into a transformer, like a little cardboard transformer suit, which is super cute. And very if Bruce cute. Had done that, he deserved to win.
I mean, fair, yeah. You couldn't argue with that if that was in fact what he did, but I kind of doubt it.
Isalou did make me laugh by saying, I was picturing him like one of the trains from Starlight Express.
Wonderful.
You also, I mean, you know how much we love this. Quite a few people were tagging themselves. you know that we always love the tagging. Casey Longstreet said, I'm Lila's powder blue princess phone, always around for the hot goss and convoluted plot paths.
The most convoluted plot points of all, honestly.
News from Neon said, oh no, I think you should read this one out. Can you see it?
Yes. I am the handkerchief that transforms Jeremy into evil cookie monster.
Marnie McFly made a reference to the fact that when I was high on cough medicine last time, very strong cold and flu medicine, I was mixing my metaphors, and she says, I am in fact the brightest tool in the box. I've been polished up right nice, ready for all your sweet belly hardware needs.
Oh my god, so good. I did like, oh yes, Photog Shan 20 said, I am the horn on Bruce's Porsche costume that goes beep beep every time he sits down.
I can't find it. I'm trying to scroll down. This is the thing when they're not all in one thread, it is it's harder to find them. But yes, here it is. I'm Wretched Chinchilla said, I'm the seamstress chained up in the basement of Patman Manor, once forced to endlessly embroider X's on leather jackets, now required to construct insanely high concept Halloween costumes.
Oh my god, free the seamstress. Poor lady.
Bibliarchaeologist says, I am the ominous blood moon. All caps. Nice.
Love that.
Jed B's Gill said, I am the superfluous ha-has, following the sound of laughing, Jessica's dream.
Oh god, I forgot about the mad dream.
The Stargazer said, I am the bat in the attic, enjoying the melodrama playing out in my home.
Wonderful.
Sister Betty Confetti said, I am Andy, the soulful soft boy, marine biology major and photography dork that you didn't realize was also a sporty hunk. I am just as dreamy as Ken Matthews. I am Kenoff.
So good. Oh my god.
We got a few references to the Dojo Mojo Casa House as well.
Yes.
Which won't say more about in case there's anybody out there who hasn't seen Barbie, but
fair. Yeah, that's fair.
Go and see Barbie. If you like this podcast, you will enjoy it.
I think so. Yeah, I did enjoy. Maria Teresa Biblioteca said, I am Sam Diamond's roommate, Roberta December, wondering why my glamorous femme roommate failed to tell me that she attended SVU, which sounds imaginary, and that she's somehow still in touch with some idiot classmate called Ned Wakefield. I'm rethinking this entire relationship now and headed to my favorite bar, Puss in Boots, to talk this over with my friends who also have roommates.
Give us that fan fiction, people.
I love it. I love Sam Diamond so much. I need more of her.
But we actually did not get the Sam Diamond name pun, because I think I was just thinking of like Diamond, like, you know, it is a surname, like Mike D from the Beastie Boys. But Lady Zanna One said, ah yes, private detective Sam Diamond, the lesser of the famous private eye Sams, always in the shadow of famous detective Sam Spade. but Sam Diamond's presence makes one hope for the existence of private eye Sam Harsh and Sam Club. So I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. because seriously, this series love a cheesy pun.
So true.
Sam Diamond, for Tog Shan said, is definitely played by Kate McKinnon in a cool white suit, kicking ass and taking names.
Well, now I definitely fancy her. Okay, are you happy?
There was also a lot of discussion about the meal quick empire and its alleged value.
Yeah, I think everybody was quite surprised by how low value it appeared to be.
Shocking.
Oh my God, ridiculous. Sorry, I'm trying to find, Oh yes, again, this is Maria Teresa back on the case. Did some digging about the frozen dinners industry. So apparently on Wikipedia, in June 2018, Conagara Brands announced the acquisition of Pinnacle Foods for $8.1 billion. So apparently this Conagra Brands, it's like a giant American packaged foods corporation. Pinnacle Foods was the company licensed to use like a Swanson Frozen Dinners name, which is this huge brand. But basically, these are like deals that are like billions and billions of dollars in 2018. And we're supposed to believe that in the 90s, Sue was only going to inherit $500K from her mother, a frozen dinner heiress. Come on, justice for me, quick. So a lot of theories abound then about meal quick being embroiled in scandals about unsavory meats or tainted meats or dubious meats in the mix. So yeah, a lot of theories there.
Wretched Chinchilla's theory was that its value was almost completely wiped out after the London Journal posed an expose revealing their products contained werewolf meat. Vivian Shirley said, at least it wasn't people. But Wretched Chinchilla said, I don't know. Has anyone seen Mandy Farmer and Tad Johnson lately?
Oh my God, the plot thickens.
By the way, we asked somebody, we asked you all, if anybody could mock up Caroline as Gollum. And thank you to Jessica Taylor on Twitter, who did give us a picture of Gollum Pierce. And it's quite accurate, I think.
It's both accurate and horrifying. But thank you so much for sending it to us, because it's fucking great.
That I would like to see on a cover. I mean, all bets are off. Like, they've forgotten what Caroline looks like a long time ago. If we ever see her on a cover again, she could have, like, she could have blonde hair, because they just do not care about
They've run out of fucks for these covers 100%. It's just like, you know what? Do any old shit. It's fine.
Well, listeners, thank you so much for sharing your images, your theories. Continue to tag yourself, please, because it is always hilarious. Oh, like, gosh. I wish we had time to read out every single one, but
it's
they
so good. We love all of them.
Yeah. And thank you so much for the offers of Sweet Valley University books this very afternoon. A package arrived at my door from listener Elizabeth. I don't know if you want to give your full name, with abundance of SVUs. And that I appreciate it so much. Please do keep your offers coming. As we did say on Pi Beta Alpha last week, if you do have any spares, and by the way, I will pay postage. Like, I'm not expecting you to like ship these things from America or Australia or wherever. If any of you are in Ireland, like, I could just meet you.
You just hang out for a bit and give us your books. Yeah.
But do please email us at svhpodcast@gmail.com, because the thing with DMs, especially on Instagram, is that they do get lost quite quickly. So I know we've had a few offers that I think we've missed, because obviously the DMs on Instagram is just the same spot as like just emoji reactions to stories and stuff, and stuff disappears really quickly before you can reply. So thank you so much for all the offers so far. And I know there were a few emails after last week's episode, so I will get back to you ASAP, because as I said on Pi Beta Alpha last week, I have a copy of the first one, and it is actually kind of good, like properly good.
I mean, yeah, you see, you keep saying that, but the thought of Sweet Valley being good on purpose, I don't buy it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, when I say good, like, the bar is low. However,
It is underground.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, just bear that in mind. But like, its depiction of Liz not fitting in college and basically losing her sister and her friends is actually quite poignant. Aww. So, I had completely forgotten how terrifyingly, I do remember there were like white supremacists in Sweet Valley, but I had forgotten that they are quite mainstream. So that is the one thing that I would warn anybody who is picking up this series, is that it does attempt to deal with some quite serious topics, but it is weirdly gripping. I mean, I feel ashamed of saying these words about anything from the Francine Pascal universe, but like,
these last 6 years meant nothing.
I know. I'm just going to give up right now on the podcast. I'm sorry. I've gone to the dark side.
Well, in fact, I think the day this goes out is the 10th. And that actually is our birthday. We are not organized, because if we were, we would have made something of that. But yeah, it's 6 years of Double Love. Happy birthday to us.
Happy birthday. And thank you to all our listeners, both those who've been with us, God help you, from the very beginning, and those who discovered us later on. We know from your emails and messages that quite a few of you have discovered us, you know, in more recent times. And
honestly, God help you guys who powered through like 5 or 6 years of podcasts in a matter of months, because that just can't be good for you.
As they get longer and madder with every year.
We just hope you're all okay.
Well, if you still can't get enough of us with an episode every 2 weeks, we are, of course, recapping the Sweet Valley High TV series over in the Pi Beta Alpha Clubhouse. And you can find out more about that by signing up to Headstuff Plus.
Yep. So if you head on over to headstuffpodcast.com, you can sign up to support the show. And when you do so, you can do it for as little as €5 a month. And that gets you access to all our bonus content, which is, of course, our parallel series, Pi Beta Alpha, where we're hanging out in the clubhouse. We are doing our best not to be like wildly thirsty over Winston, and we always fail.
We always fail. Every single episode.
Every single time. I feel like only recently I was like, I am going to be normal about Winston in this episode. I was not. No. Didn't happen. So
he was dressed up as an old-timey director.
What were we supposed to do?
Exactly.
So it's loads of fun. It's fucking chaos. It's great crack, because the episodes, like, honestly, you think you get a handle on that series and then something completely deranged happens. And we're just like, did that actually happen? What's going on? But it's great fun. So do join us for the off weeks between Double Love episodes if you want even more of us cackling in your ears.
Indeed. And remember, if you sign up, you'll have access to our entire backlist, and you will get the super secret RSS feed to put in your podcatcher of choice. So, you know, you don't have to listen to these bonus episodes on the Headstuff Plus website. You can just listen to them as you would any other podcast. So we will see our Pi Beta Alpha siblings over in the clubhouse next week, when we find out what happens when a star is torn.
Ooh, okay.
They've got some good puns in recently.
They've been good. Yeah, it's been pretty solid lately. Good wordplay.
Yeah, we had shakes, fries and videotapes last time, which
still
was
the number one. Yeah,
absolutely fantastic. But we'll see you there for A Star Is Torn. But we will see everybody in the main feed in 2 weeks' time.
When it's Christmas.
I mean, we literally had Christmas in The Evil Twin, and we had that episode, even though we are doing two, you know, splitting everything. It's a book a month, basically, now. And like, that was long after our actual, what was actual human Christmas for us?
Human Christmas.
As opposed to Sweet Valley Christmas. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like the real world of Barbie Land. Yes,
actual human Christmas for actual humans. Oh, yeah. You better dig out those jingle bells for the next one. That's all I know.
Oh shit, I should, because we're going to have Christmas in August.
Hell yeah. What are we, Australia?
I mean, in fairness, the weather here is more like December, so, you know.
True.
But we will be celebrating Christmas, I guess.
Not human Christmas, Sweet Valley Christmas.
Seriously, watching Barbie has affected my brain. So, yes, we will see you back here in 2 weeks' time when the twins celebrate another Not that long after decking the halls with bloody bodies.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to celebrate a deadly Christmas.
Oh, my God.
Part one. See you then, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Ho, ho, ho.
Bye, Barbie.
Bye, Barbie.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.